Chapter 60. And confess to myself that I haven't any romance literature appetite, as far as I can see, except for your books. But what I started to say was that I have just read part 2 of Indian Summer, and to my mind there isn't a waistline in it, or one that could be improved. I read it yesterday, ending with that opinion, and read it again today, ending with the same opinion emphasized. I haven't read part I yet, because that number must have reached Hartford after we left, but we are going to send downtown for a copy, and when it comes I am to read both parts aloud to the family. It is a beautiful story, and makes a body laugh all the time, and cry inside, and feel so old and so forlorn, and gives him gracious glimpses of his lost youth that fill him with a measureless regret, and build up in him a cloudy sense of his having been a prince, once, in some enchanted far-off land, and of being an exile now, and desolate and lord, no chance ever to get back there again. That is the thing that hurts. Well, you have done it with marvelous facility and you make all the motives and feelings perfectly clear without analyzing the guts out of them, the way George Eliot does. I can't stand George Eliot and Hawthorne and those people. I see what they are at 100 years, before they get to it, and they just tire me to death. And as for the Bostonians, I would rather be damned to John Bunyan's heaven than read that. Here's ever Mark, it is as easy to understand Mark Twain's enjoyment of Indian Summer as his revolt against Daniel Deronda and the Bostonians. He cared little for writing that did not convey its purpose in the simplest and most direct terms. It is interesting to note that in thanking Clemens for his compliment Howells wrote, colon, what people cannot see is that I analyze as little as possible. They go on talking about the analytical school, which I am supposed to belong to, and I want to thank you for using your eyes. Did you ever read Defoe's Roxana? If not, then read it, not merely for some of the deepest insights into the lying, suffering, sinning, well-meaning human soul, but for the best and most natural English that a book was ever written in. General Grant worked steadily on his book, dictating when he could, making brief notes on slips of paper when he could no longer speak. Clemens visited him at Mountain McGregor and brought the dying soldier the comforting news that enough of his books were already sold to provide generously for his family, and that the sales would aggregate at least twice as much by the end of the year. This was some time in July. On the 23rd of that month, General Grant died. Immediately there was a newspaper discussion as to the most suitable place for the great chieftain to lie. Mark Twain's contribution to this debate, though in the form of an open letter, seems worthy of preservation here. To the New York Un, on the proper place for Grant's tomb. To the editor of the Sun. Sir, the newspaper atmosphere is charged with objections to New York as a place of sepulchre for General Grant, and the objectors are strenuous that Washington is the right place. They offer good reasons, good temporary reasons, for both of these positions. But it seems to me that temporary reasons are not meet for the occasion. We need to consider posterity rather than our own generation. We should select a grave which will not merely be in the right place now, but will still be in the right place 500 years from now. How does Washington promise as to that? You have only to hit it in one place to kill it. Someday the West will be numerically strong enough to move the seat of government. Her past attempts are a fair warning that when the day comes she will do it. Then the city of Washington will lose its consequence and pass out of the public view and public talk. It is quite within the possibilities that, a century hence, people would wonder and say, how did your predecessors come to bury their great dead in this deserted place? But as long as American civilization lasts, New York will last. I cannot but think as he has been well and wisely chosen as the guardian of a grave which is destined to become almost the most conspicuous in the world's history. 20 centuries from now, New York will still be New York, still a vast city, and the most notable object in it will still be the tomb and monument of General Grant. I observe that the common and strongest objection to New York is that she is not national ground. Let us give ourselves no uneasiness about that. Wherever General Grant's body lies, that is national ground. S50. Clemens. Elmira, July 27. The letter that follows is very long, but it seems too important and too interesting to be omitted in any part. General Grant's early indulgence in liquors had long been a matter of wide, though not very definite, knowledge. Everyone had heard how Lincoln, on being told that Grant drank, remarked something to the effect that he would like to know what kind of whiskey Grant used, so that he might get some of it for his other generals. Henry Ward Beecher, selected to deliver a eulogy on the dead soldier, and doubtless wishing neither to ignore the matter nor to make too much of it, naturally turned for information to the publisher of Grant's own memoirs, hoping from an advance copy to obtain light. To Henry Ward Beecher, B. Brooklyn. Elmira, NY, September 11, 85. My dear Mr. Beecher, my nephew Webster is in Europe making contracts for the memoirs. Before he sailed, he came to me with a writing, directed to the printers and binders, to this effect. Honor no order for a cider copy of the memoirs, while I am absent, even though it be signed by Mr. Clemens himself. I gave my permission. There were weighty reasons why I should not only give my permission, but hold it a matter of honor to not dissolve the order or modify it at any time. So I did all of that, said the order should stand undisturbed to the end. If a principal could dissolve his promise as innocently as he can dissolve his written order unguarded by his promise, I would send you a copy of the memoirs instantly. I did not foresee you, or I would have made an exception. My idea gained from army men is that the drunkenness and sometimes pretty reckless spreeing nights ceased before he came east to be lieutenant general. Refer especially to General W.M. B. Franklin. If you could see Franklin and talk with him, then he would unbosom. It was while Grant was still in the West that Mr. Lincoln said he wished he could find out what brand of whiskey that fellow used, so he could furnish it to some of the other generals. Franklin saw Grant tumble from his horse drunk while reviewing troops in New Orleans. The fall gave him a good deal of a hurt. He was then on the point of leaving for the Chattanooga region. I naturally put that and that together when I read General O. Howard's article in the Christian Union, 3 or 4 weeks ago, where he mentions that the new general arrived lame from a recent accident. See that article. And why not write Howard? Franklin spoke positively of the frequent spreeing in camp in time of war. Captain Grant was frequently threatened by the commandant of his Oregon post with a report to the War Department of his conduct, unless he modified his intemperance. The report would mean dismissal from the service. At last the report had to be made out, and then, so greatly was the captain beloved, that he was privately informed, and was thus enabled to rush his resignation to Washington ahead of the report. Did the report go, nevertheless? I don't know. If it did, it is in the War Department now, possibly, and seeable. I got all this from a regular army man, but I can't name him to save me. The only time General Grant ever mentioned liquor to me was about last April or possibly May. He said, if I could only build up my strength. The doctors urge whiskey and champagne, but I can't take them. I can't abide the taste of any kind of liquor. Had he made a conquest so complete that even the taste of liquor was become an offense? Or was he so sore over what had been said about his habit that he wanted to persuade others, and likewise himself, that he hadn't even ever had any taste for it? It sounded like the latter, but that's no evidence. He told me in the fall of 84 that there was something the matter with his throat, and that at the suggestion of his physicians he had reduced his smoking to one cigar a day. Then he added, in a casual fashion, that he didn't care for that one, and seldom smoked it. I could understand that feeling. He had set out to conquer not the habit, but the inclination, the desire. He had gone at the root, not the trunk. It's the perfect way and the only true way, I speak from experience. How I do hate those enemies of the human race who go around enslaving God's free people with pledges to quit drinking instead of to quit wanting to drink. But Sherman and Van Vliet know everything concerning Grant, and if you tell them how you want to use the facts, both of them will testify. Regular army men have no concealments about each other, and yet they make their awful statements without shade, or color or malice, with a frankness and a childlike naivety, indeed, which is enchanting and stupefying. West Point seems to teach them that, among other priceless things, not to be got in any other college in this world. If we talked about our guildmates as I have heard Sherman, Grant, Van Vliet and others talk about theirs, mates with whom they were on the best possible terms, we could never expect them to speak to us again. I am reminded, now, of another matter. The day of the funeral I sat an hour over a single drink and several cigars with Van Vliet and Sherman and Senator Sherman. And among other things, Jen. Sherman said, with impatient scorn, "The idea of all this nonsense about Grant not being able to stand rude language and indelicate stories. Why, Grant was full of humor, and full of the appreciation of it. I have sat with him by the hour listening to Jim Nye's yarns, and I reckon you know the style of Jim Nye's histories, Clemens. It makes me sick, that newspaper nonsense. Grant was no namby-dash-pammy fool, he was a man all over rounded and complete. I wish I had thought of it. I would have said to General Grant, put the drunkenness in the memoirs and the repentance and reform. Trust the people. But I will wager there is not a hint in the book. He was sore, there. As much of the book as I have read gives no hint, as far as I recollect." The sick room brought out the points of Jen. Grant's character, some of them particularly, to wit. His patience, his indestructible equability of temper, his exceeding gentleness, kindness, forbearance, lovingness, charity, his loyalty to friends, to convictions, to promises, half-promises, infinitesimal fractions and shadows of promises. There was a requirement of him which I considered an atrocity, an injustice, an outrage. I wanted to implore him to repudiate it. Fred Grant said, "Save your labor, I know him. He is in doubt as to whether he made that half-promise or not, and he will give the thing the benefit of the doubt. He will fulfill that half-promise, or kill himself trying." Fred Grant was right, he did fulfill it. His aggravatingly trustful nature, his genuineness, simplicity, modesty, diffidence, self-depreciation, poverty in the quality of vanity dash, and, in no contradiction of this last, his simple pleasure in the flowers and general ruck sent to him by Tom, Dick, and Harry from everywhere, a pleasure that suggested a perennial surprise that he should be the object of so much fine attention. He was the most lovable great child in the world. I mentioned his loyalty. You remember Harrison, the colored body servant? The whole family hated him, but that did not make any difference. The general always stood at his back, wouldn't allow him to be scolded, always excused his failures and deficiencies with the one unvarying formula, "We are responsible for these things in his race, it is not fair to visit our fault upon them, let him alone." So they did let him alone, under compulsion, until the great heart that was his shield was taken away. Then, well, they simply couldn't stand him, and so they were excusable for determining to discharge him, a thing which they mortally hated to do, and by lucky accident were saved from the necessity of doing. His toughness as a bargainer, when doing business for other people or for his country, witness his terms at Donelson, Vicksburg, etc. Fred Grant told me his father wound up an estate for the widow and orphans of a friend in St. Louis. It took several years. At the end, every complication had been straightened out, and the property put upon a prosperous basis. Great sums had passed through his hands, and when he handed over the papers there were vouchers, to show what had been done with every penny, and his trusting, easy, unexacting fashion when doing business for himself. At that same time he was paying out money in driblets to a man who was running his farm for him, and in his first presidency he paid every one of those driblets again, total, $3,000, F said. For he hadn't a scrap of paper to show that he had ever paid them before. In his dealings with me, he would not listen to terms which would place my money at risk, and leave him protected. The thought plainly gave him pain, and he put it from him, waved it off with his hands, as one does accounts of crushings and mutilations. Wouldn't listen, changed the subject, and his fortitude. He was under sentence of death last spring. He sat thinking, musing, several days nobody knows what about. Then he pulled himself together, and set to work to finish that book, a colossal task for a dying man. Presently his hand gave out. Fate seemed to have got him checkmated. Dictation was suggested. No, he never could do that. Had never tried it. Too old to learn now. By and by, if he could only do Appomattox well. So he sent for a stenographer, and dictated 9,000 words at a single sitting. Never pausing, never hesitating for a word, never repeating, and in the written out copy he made hardly a correction. He dictated again, every 2 or 3 days. The intervals were intervals of exhaustion and slow recuperation, and at last he was able to tell me that he had written more matter than could be got into the book. I then enlarged the book, had to. Then he lost his voice. He was not quite done yet, however. There was no end of little plums and spices to be stuck in, here and there, and this work he patiently continued, a few lines a day, with pad and pencil, till far into July, at Mount McGregor. One day he put his pencil aside, and said he was done. There was nothing more to do. If I had been there, I could have foretold the shock that struck the world 3 days later. Well, I've written all this, and it doesn't seem to amount to anything. But I do want to help, if I only could. I will enclose some scraps from my autobiography, scraps about General Grant. They may be of some trifle of use, and they may not. They at least verify known traits of his character. My autobiography is pretty freely dictated. But my idea is to jack plane it a little before I die, someday or other. I mean the rude construction and rotten grammar. It is the only dictating I ever did, and it was most troublesome and awkward work. You may return it to Hartford. Sincerely yours, S50. Clemens. The old long-deferred library of humor came up again for discussion, when in the fall of 1885 Howells associated himself with Harper and Brothers. Howells' contract provided that his name was not to appear on any book not published by the Harper firm. He wrote, therefore, offering to sell out his interest in the enterprise for $2,000, in addition to the $500 which he had already received, an amount considered to be less than he was to have received as joint author and compiler. Mark Twain's answer pretty fully covers the details of this undertaking. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Hartford, October 18, 1885. Private. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.